Welcome to Get Down to College Business. We will identify strategies that could make the difference between keeping university doors open and closing them for good. I'm pulling in business experts and higher ed leaders to debate the merits of strategies that could save the future of higher ed. I'm your host, Sarah Holton, PhD. Let's get down to college business. Hi, everyone. This is Sarah Holton and your host. I'm joined today by Professor Sean Jones, an assistant professor of computer science at Milwaukee School of Engineering. Sean specializes in applied AI, focusing on language and computers. He is currently involved in research regarding the use and development of AI language models, such as ChatGPT in education. Sean, when you and I first met in summer of 2023, you said something to me along the lines of, you know, a year ago, no one knew what I did, and now I'm a hot commodity, which I believe because I sat through your presentation on executives who wanted to upskill themselves on ChatGPT. And I know the audience had, we had kind of a mixed audience that day. Half the audience was up on this and wanting to know how to implement it in their workforce. And the other half of it, me probably, was like, I think I know what it is, but do I really? And I was so impressed with how you managed to really convey the information that we needed to know to be better in our workplace. And you also had a little bit of fun. You had us laughing as much as thinking. And so I know our audience today is going to learn from your expertise. So welcome.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Oh, great. So let's start with the obvious. What is ChatGPT and why is it so big right now in higher ed?
Yeah. So what it is at its core is it's a chat bot, which is basically a machine that tries to have an interaction or communication with whoever is talking to it. So the person would enter some kind of prompt, some information, a question, a statement or whatever, and then GPT responds. And the goal is to make it sound as human as possible. And GPT does a really good job of being human and of attempting to at least look like it understands what you're saying and give you something reasonable back. The reason it's such a big deal now is kind of twofold. One is that it got really lucky. So it was the first of its kind to blow up. There had been other models that were performing all right, but ChatGPT went public about a year and a half ago, and it had an easy access to the technology. Because before then, you would have to actually know what you were doing and have some basic programming skills to be able to use one. They gave them a nice little website. You click, you enter something, and bam, you're there. And so because it was so easy, it took off. They had millions of users. They had a million users, I think, in the first several days. And it went from there. The reason academia cares about it more is there's also a lot of information baked into ChatGPT, which is very much like Google, but a whole lot easier to talk to. And so students in particular were really leveraging ChatGPT to try and get answers. Whether or not those answers were accurate is another thing, but they were trying. And so that's one of the reasons that's become such a big deal.
It's interesting when I'm hearing you talk about it, it's almost like you're talking about the user having a relationship with ChatGPT. Like it wants to please us. It wants to help us. We work with ChatGPT. It's not just like a Google.
Well, and that's exactly how it was designed. They made it specifically to be this assistant, to be something you would interact with. Because the initial idea behind chatbots, this goes a long ways back, was a Turing test. In other words, can it fool you into thinking that it's human? And there have been systems that have done it in very different ways. GPT was the first one that could do it on a variety of topics and could do it for a long period of time. And so that's, again, one of the reasons it's so big. It's not the only one. There's plenty of others out there now. But because it's the most popular and it's still free to an extent to use and easy to use, that's why it's kind of what everyone is talking about.
Which absolutely makes sense, right? It's convenient, it's free, and it's helpful. Of
right.
course, we are going to use it. So in my own circles, I hear people sounding a little nervous about ChatGPT. I believe the nervousness stems partly from uncertainty, right? What is it? And how do we control it? We want to maintain academic integrity. That's always our goal. So would this encroach on that academic integrity? I think some people might be worried it might also take over their jobs or be used inappropriately. What's your reaction to people who are nervous about this?
So it's understandable, right? It really is. Because A, anytime something new and it's doing something you're not really sure what it's doing, it's hard to wrap your head around and you're not sure you trust exactly what it's doing. But in this particular case, both fears are founded, like the fact that, yes, there is some academic integrity issues that are going to come up with it. And as far as jobs go, it's not smart enough to simply replace people yet. And I'm using the word yet because it's improving every day. So when it started a year and a half ago, it was out of date by a couple of years to begin with. In fact, in other words, its knowledge only went up to a certain time. That's constantly changing, and they're updating it, and it's improving, and it's getting better. But people's jobs currently, most jobs, require a certain amount of basic human intelligence, and GPT does not have that. And so it's very good at retrieving and generating things, retrieving information, generating things, and giving them to you, but it doesn't really understand what you're doing. And so without going into real depth about why it doesn't, at this point, there's still human interaction needed to make it work. Now, it's making things far more efficient, making people more efficient, making them more productive. And so could you do the same amount of work with a reduced workforce? Depending on the job, yes. And so that's, I think, where people's nervousness is founded, because people are going to worry about, if there's five of us and they only need three of us, then who's not going to be there, right?
What's your prediction for how soon that yet becomes it's here?
So I don't want to give an actual answer. I don't want to put my name on an answer. And because
You could be a prophet right now.
Yeah. So I'm teaching currently my NLP class, the natural language processing class, which covers this. In fact, right after spring break, we're diving in and learning how all this works. And I've already, from the summer till now, I've rewritten my entire course two times. And I'm in the process of updating it again, because things are changing so fast that what I had at the summer is now completely outdated and no one does it. And so it's because it's going so fast, it's really hard to figure out where it's going fast and at what point the things that we're worried about are going to come to fruition. At the end of the day, though, they're not intelligent. Computers really aren't. They're really fast and they're really good at holding a lot of information and sifting through patterns and giving you something, but it doesn't know why. The overall intelligence isn't there. And so that's still the main limiting factor. So until we can actually start teaching a computer to reason, which we haven't yet, we don't have to worry about that. We don't have to worry about Skynet taking over or anything like that. But people whose jobs are largely repetitive or largely content generating, that's going to be pretty soon. In fact, we're already seeing it. Journalists, there are far less journalists now because a lot of articles are being written by AI. And you don't even know all the ones that are being written by AI yet. Sports reporting has been AI 50 to 70% for the last 3 or 4 years.
Let's focus on students for the moment and talk me through some of the academic integrity issues that college leaders, faculty members, staff members should be worried about. And then tell us about if you're noticing any differences at the undergraduate versus graduate level or any kind of differences within academic programs.
Okay. So there's, depending on the kind of academic work you're doing, you have different problems. So if you are, in my case, computer science, where students are doing programming and that kind of thing, GPT is very good at very basic coding. And so the early courses, it's possible for students to basically get, not all their answers, because they still have to know what they're doing, but get a number of assignments where they get a significant amount of help could come directly from GPT, just asking, here, write this for me, and it will. That fails because GPT, again, doesn't know anything. And so then as soon as you make your assignment a little more complicated, it's easy to tell that that's the case, right? So for the computer science side, it's a problem, but it's not that bad. Over on the humanities side, where there's a lot of writing, and it really is all about writing, it's entirely possible that someone can use GPT and in about 30 minutes have a 10-page paper. Now, the quality of the 10-page paper, so this is the problem, is that GPT looks like a mediocre sophomore high school level essay. I'm being a little sarcastic, but it kind of does, right? Well, how different is that from a freshman comm essay? It's going to be kind of the same thing. And so trying to determine, are they just not very good at writing, or is this ChatGPT? As silly as it sounds, it's actually really hard to do. And there are no tools to do that. And if you're a decent student and you're just lazy, you could have it generate that and then make some changes and then make it sound more human. And then you're not doing the work. And really, that's what it comes down to. We're trying to give them practice so they can learn skills. But if they're just learning one skill, which is make this thing do it for me, then we're taking away from what we're trying to teach them, right? So depending on what we're asking them to do, the threat, I guess you call it, is higher. Grad students are a very different breed because they've already made it through undergrad and they're usually very focused on what they're trying to do. And so they use GPT much more the way I would see faculty use it, which is they have a question about something and they want a general answer. And so they ask it, they get a general answer, and then they know what to look for and they know what to then research more carefully. And I've seen them do that in a number of cases, especially because they pointed out how wrong it was. We were asking them to do something computer related and they got an answer. They said, this isn't right, is it? And they showed it to me and it certainly wasn't right, but GPT didn't know it wasn't right. It just looked right, so it gave it to it. So there are concerns, and we actually at MSO we built into our academic dishonesty policy a whole section on generative AI, what's acceptable, what's not, because we don't want them to just avoid it and never use it, because it's there. It's it would be like saying, no, you're never going to be able to use a calculator, you know, which when I was going to school, they did tell us that. And now that's not the case, right?
You won't always have a calculator in your pocket. Right? Turns out we do.
We do, yes. We have several. Yeah.
So can you think of an example? It could be a general example of how to craft an assignment to reduce the potential for AI use?
Yeah. In fact, we're doing that. So in particular in the CS department, because we're more aware and in tune with what's happening, we were the first, right away, we were starting to do this. So there's two different ways you can do this. One, you can teach the students the good and the bad early on to hopefully dissuade them from using it, which is what we do in our freshman programming sequence. We give them a couple of examples of here's a question that GPT can help you with, but this is where it's not complete and where it's not going to work. And then we have them walk through examples of it so they can see where it's good and where it's bad. So that's one. And as far as making an assignment that will be challenging for GPT to just completely write, all you have to do is make something slightly not standard. And what I mean by that is in coding, for example, there's a lot of very standard patterns and questions and things like that. So if you take a standard question and then you change it a little bit, because the machine itself isn't smart, it sees the bulk of the program that you're asking to be the same as 17 other things that it's seen. And so that's what it's going to give you. It doesn't know that there's this little change, and that means the code has to be different. For example, in the case of a writing assignment, you could have them discuss something, but then make them bring in something from their personal life. So then you can't rely on an external source to generate the information for you.
Unless you have a really good relationship with your personal ChatGPT. Okay. So just to make sure that our audience caught those two tips, first of all, probably we need to educate students when they're coming into our colleges, really what the boundaries of AI is, right? There's great uses, there's things that are appropriate, and then there's also things that aren't. So educating them first, and then crafting our assignments to be slightly not standard.
Right.
And that would vary by discipline, what that would look like.
Yeah, it also means that a lot of the old multiple choice tests are probably, if you're going to do them, you don't make them take home. Because if they've been asked enough, then GPT's probably seen similar things enough to give you the right answer.
Or close enough to get a passing grade.
Exactly.
It might not be perfect, but you'd pass.
Yep, yep.
Okay, so tell me about these policies themselves. You talked about how MSOE has some AI policies. Talk me through how college leaders should design these policies for appropriate student use. Tell us about any models that you might look to or that our audience could kind of look at themselves if they wanted to kind of have a model to start with.
Yeah, and that's a really good question. So when we first started doing this, it had been a year and a half ago, right about then, there were no models. There was nothing. And so we were kind of going blind. Now there's a number of universities. MIT has a bunch of really good resources, specifically though for students and faculty. Administration, I still haven't found anything useful for that. What we've done is approach it in two different ways. So as far as faculty goes, we've set kind of limitations on what we expect faculties to make students do in their classroom. So students are not required at any time to put their personal information into some kind of AI system. That said, the faculty is encouraged to at least approach it and discuss it with their students. This is what it is, and this is how it could be used in whatever discipline we're teaching. As far as academic dishonesty goes, we have a bunch of examples. So what we've done is we've taken, this is acceptable use, this is not acceptable use. We've done probably about 20 different examples of different types of academic dishonesty, some of them being AI, some of them not. To give the students some concrete example, because usually when students see this, here's your policy, and your policy says you may use it for this, but not this, or this is how, they don't know what you mean, right? And until you give them concrete examples, then they can see how this relates to the work they're doing. And then they at least have less plausible deniability when something comes up. As far as the administration goes, this is tough. We were very fortunate that our administration is all in on what we want to do, and specifically what our department, which is doing the research, is interested in doing. But looking into what they are doing that could be assisted with AI, I guess is the best thing I could say. But again, there's no real model for that because everyone's administration is different. Everyone's institution is different in what they need and what they're looking for. And so there's no magic bullet is what it comes down to. With faculty and students, there are patterns, just like we talked about. that we can show or that we can think about. But at an institutional level, much like other businesses, AI is good for helping them with their content. But then there's, without going into too much detail, there's a whole bunch of risks that are associated with that.
So I'm picturing marketing, social media departments latching onto this and saying, hey, we need fresh content on a regular basis. Maybe that would be a unit that could look to AI
Absolutely.
For assistance or Absolutely. The good use.
Yeah. Now the downside with that, because first of all, yes, and that is where it's being used a lot, especially in business. But the more it gets used, AI is trained on not only what it's managed to learn, but also what's been input. So every time you use a device, a system, unless it's very explicitly determined in the terms of service, they're taking what you've put in and using that as training for what comes out later. So you end up, initially, it's very novel and new, but then it learns novel and new, and then it's going to start eventually repeating or bringing in that information again and again. You kind of water it down, essentially.
I think I'm understanding. It sort of becomes this one trick pony.
Yeah, except it's a many trick pony, okay. But it's the same many tricks.
Okay, gotcha. So you still need the human element for fresh creative ideas.
Yes, and that is probably the most important thing to know about current AI is that it cannot be creative on its own. It can show you all sorts of examples of things that it's seen and combinations of examples, and you might come up with inspiration based on what it's given you, which is where a lot of people end up using this. But it itself, yeah, it cannot create something brand new.
Going back to the student policies, how often do you think they'll need to be updated? You're talking about how fast AI is changing and that your syllabus from last summer, you know,
yeah.
7-8 months later is already out of date. How often are schools going to have to update these?
So probably revisiting them every year because you're never going to keep up with everything that's going on. The ideas are pretty much the same though. So the capabilities are changing and so they're improving in what the response is going to be. But if your policies are such that you want them to use it for assistance and for inspiration, but not for doing the work and you've crafted it that way, then that's not really going to change. Because that's the basic idea is that this is a tool. This is just like when computers first came around, we were using them instead of typewriters. When Google was around and we didn't have to go to the library and look for encyclopedias, right? We're evolving, things are moving forward. And so it's just a matter of adapting to this is how people are going to be getting information. So then how do we want to guide them when they're doing that?
Keep talking about tactical advice for colleges. So faculty, staff, administrators, what do they need to know tactically speaking? Like how to embrace this, how to use it appropriately. It could be related to say enrollment management, maybe measuring outcomes such as retention, graduation, HR processes, IT, anything, any unit that you can picture in a higher education institute. What do they need to know? What do they need to do? What do they need to have done yesterday?
So it's funny. Microsoft has an entire section of one of their websites dedicated to business AI and all the different things that AI can do. What is completely missing from that is academia. They've got finance, they've got government, but they don't have academia. And so a lot of what we do in academia, as far as the administrative level, is generally statistical analysis. So what GPT can do, as an example, I'm just going to use GPT as the shorthand for any of these models, is that it can help you identify patterns. It can help you visualize patterns. It can modern GPT is actually able to generate, well, GPT associated stuff can help you generate images and graphs and charts and things. But a lot of what we do is still human based, right? And so there's some very specific failings that AI has had recently that we're still trying to address in HR specifically. Like I don't know how much people have heard about Amazon, but Amazon had a system where it was just basically trying to filter through resumes so they could hire people. Well, turned out the bot was trained. It was trained on real data. And so there was nothing wrong with the way it was trained, but the data was so biased that it ended up rejecting women because the typical Amazon worker was male. And so it just became this overbalanced thing where, okay, I guess male is what we want. As far as the AI is concerned, again, they don't know anything. They just look at numbers. And so we've got problems like that. Earlier, this is about a decade ago, there was an AI system, maybe even more than that, because I'm getting old. There was an AI system that was filtering mortgage approval. And turns out they're filtering by zip code, which meant that when a person of color was putting the exact same application in as a white person, the person of color was getting denied, the white person was not getting denied. And again, it wasn't a malicious thing. It was just the AI not being smart enough to recognize what it was doing. And so it's really, I really caution HR to increase their use of AI until that kind of bias detection has been improved, because that's a very serious topic of research right now, and it's very early stages right now. We don't know a lot. We know it's there. We don't have a good way of combating it yet.
Right, and AI simply reflects the biases of the humans that have inputted the information.
And sometimes not even the people, but sometimes the society, right? Like GPT, for example, is trained on the internet, which essentially it grabbed an entire chunk of the internet and learned it, which is good because that's modern society. That's what we are. The downside is there's good and bad everywhere. And so it grabbed all of it and it doesn't differentiate. It doesn't know. And so there's like the example that I like to give with the internet in general is that the internet that we here in the United States use is almost exclusively American, middle class, white, male. And that's just because it started with DARPANET in the 60s and up through until very recently, in the last 20 years, it was only accessible to people that had computers, which didn't used to be everybody, with internet, which really didn't used to be everybody. And so the only people that used it were that. It was that demographic. And so much of what we see comes from that. That doesn't make it wrong. It just means it's more heavily represented that way. And so a lot of decisions that are naively made are going to be naively made with that as a bias, just because that's the information that it has.
So you're talking about the bias and discrimination that you've seen prevalent in the HR hiring processes. Would those same levels of discrimination and biases apply to AI use and enrollment management? Like, could it work against certain types of students during the admissions process?
If it was naively applied, yes. So, and I say the word naively applied because there's a lot of ways that you can influence the general model. So the way it works, and this is one of the more recent things that have come out, and actually one of the things I had to change my course about, is there's this idea of you build a general model that just takes the world as it is, it learns basically whatever you give it, and then it has that information. And then you want to make it more specific. You want to specialize that into a specific problem that you want to solve, like enrollment, for example. And so the make that happen, you would take a separate model. You would create a separate model, which, and when I use the term model, I just mean take a lot of information and then feed it into the system. And so it will then store it in the way that it understands. And so it has that information. And the term is retrieval augmented generation. That's the fancy term. It's a RAG. And what we do with it is...
That is a really unfortunate acronym. I'm just going to say that.
Oh, there are so many unfortunate acronyms in computer science because they don't think about it until after the fact. So we take our original model, and then we have this assistant model separate. And so the original model is for communication and language and all that. But the information is going to be strongly influenced by your smaller, very specific model. And so you can then go through and adjust things like that. You can also try and filter things out. The term we use is weights. You can weigh something a little more or less heavily. And so if you're concerned about it, for example, discriminating against females, which in computer science, for example, is very common because it's a very, very male-dominated industry, you can weigh it more heavily or weigh it less heavily, have gender be not important in the decision-making process, for example.
So it sounds like you simply figure out how to compensate for the variables that you suspect might be causing that discrimination.
Yeah. And that's honestly how everything is being done right now. Like GPT itself has an insane amount of filtering. So what it actually gives you is not what you see. So there's an awful lot of constant checks and balances going on in the back, lots of filters in place to steer it away from problematic things, which some people get upset about and say, I just want the raw information, but they don't really. And GPT as a business really doesn't want that because they want to have a broad base. They want to be able to, you know, make it useful for everybody. And so yeah, right now, all we do is identify problems and find ways to either remove them or make them less important in decision making. But taking them out, removing them, there's a whole discussion about whether that's a viable or not viable thing to do. Removing bias is kind of like removing bad. If you remove bad, you don't have good. And so then if you don't have an opposite, you have no sense of when something is good or bad. And so it's really challenging to figure out, can we remove this kind of bias without actually damaging the overall model and making it less human, making it less useful for us? And again, that's an area of research that is very open still.
Are there particular tools that you would recommend to colleges to help maximize AI, or are there best best tools out there that you know of right now?
So this is the $64,000 question, isn't it?
Is that how much it's going to cost each college?
Minimum, yeah.
Minimum, okay.
So the problem is the AI that we see very rarely can be run on a machine, on a regular computer. Almost all the AI that we use is run on a supercomputer. There aren't that many supercomputers in the world. And so in order to use any of them, you are going to pay Amazon or Microsoft or OpenAI or somebody to host your information. So as soon as you do that, there's several other issues that you have. So now your information is being stored not on premises, it's being stored somewhere. And if you have a good contract, they're not going to use that data, or they say they're not going to use that data. And then you have to trust that they're not going to use all the personal or proprietary data or whatever in training their model. Now, OpenAI has been very explicit that, yes, we'll spin one up for you. We'll create your own little server, and it'll be your information, and it'll be separate from our public model, and it will only train on itself, which they will. But then we have to ask ourselves how vulnerable is OpenAI to cyber attacks. And we don't know, because they're a private company and they're not going to tell us if they are. And so the moment you start using these tools, unless you can be extremely confident where they are and how they're being stored, you have to be okay with whatever information you're giving them to possibly be leaked.
So data security problems, right? Protected student information and records could potentially be jeopardized with these. Now, I just have to ask, because you talked about the three big supercomputers, but I'm also wondering if Sean Jones has one in his basement.
It seems like you would. So the short answer is it's not a hard thing to build if you have the time and money and you don't mind having an electric bill that is off the charts. So yes, people can do it, and people do that. And there are private supercomputers. Like,
is one of those people Sean Jones? This is what I'm trying. You don't want to tell us, do you? All right, we'll talk off air.
I currently don't have one.
So if a college wanted to invest in this, what would it cost them? You said at least $64,000.
I was being a little sarcastic with that, but a lot. So MSOE has a supercomputer that we're upgrading. And it was a donation from one of our alums, and it's probably one of the largest supercomputers in Milwaukee, and we're very fortunate to have it, but we would never have been able to afford it ourselves as an institution. It's in the millions of dollars to be able to.
You're talking at least seven figures.
Yes, easily. And that's just to put it in. Once you put it in, then it's got to be maintained. It has to be managed. You have to have someone that actually knows how to use it and to be able to put something on there. So there's a lot of hurdles to overcome for that. If you're okay with hosted information, and if you can be fairly certain that the stuff you're putting out there is not high value, high security, and it's really, you're just trying to use it to make your workflow more efficient, then a lot of the public models, we'll call them public, but a lot of the pay models are going to work. But then you have to figure out what you want it to do. And so there's a certain amount of expertise, even if it's not like coding expertise, there's a certain amount of data expertise that needs to go on to make a determination of what are we going to use this for, and what information are we going to give it in order to be able to use this information, to be able to use the service. And that's just some expertise that if you're going to do this, you either need to have it or you need to hire someone, that a consultant or someone that can come in and help you with that. Because garbage in, garbage out is the term we use. If you don't have the correct information going in, you're not getting any good information coming out.
Let's shift over to faculty and how they could use AI to assist them. So I'm thinking classroom preparation. I'm thinking grading and feedback, maybe research support. Am I off base here? Talk me through this. Is this possible? Is it not yet there?
Yeah, well, some of it, absolutely. So I use it whenever I'm putting together my schedule and my syllabus. I'll use it to just generate some kind of rough sequence of events and things that I want to cover and in the ways I want to cover them. And then I'll go and build it. So building syllabi, trying to think of, there were a couple of things that I had done this last term that I had just tried, and they worked well and some worked very poorly. Slide generation. If you want to have visuals, it's good at bullet points if you are very explicit at what you want it to do. Like, for example, if I have a series of facts, I will put the facts in it and tell it to generate a slide with four bullet points that'll cover these facts. And then it'll do a very good job of formatting it for me, because I'm not that good at formatting. As far as other uses for us for preparation, it's not very good at lecture notes, because it tends to be verbose. And we don't want verbose. So it's either verbose or it's bullet points and not verbose enough. And so it's a hard balance. I'm sure if I worked hard at it, I could. But in the amount of time I coaxed it to do it, I would have written it myself.
Is it a starting place, though?
Very much. And that almost exclusively is how I end up using it. But it saves me a lot of time. Because for most of us, if I have to write an email, the hardest thing is starting and what am I going to say? But if you just say, hey, write me an email like this that says this to this person, I can take that and change it around. And it's a whole lot easier and a lot faster. As far as grading, it can be very useful with some caveats again. Proofreading and detecting if things are either grammatically incorrect or don't make any sense or like should not be together. It's pretty good at that. It's very good at code debugging. So if I have some code and it's not working and I know this is the code that's not working, I can put it in and say, hey, what's wrong with this? And it'll give a suggestion as to what's wrong. And it's usually either close enough or it's actually right. So it saves you a lot of time there. Writing feedback. If you give it a bullet point list of this is the stuff I want you to tell the student, it'll do a very good job of generating a full feedback report for something if you have the information for it.
So let me make sure I understand that last part about the feedback. You still have to read the student, say an essay, right? We still have to slog through the essay, and then we would just jot down maybe say 2, 3, 4, 5 pieces that we noticed, and we could do real short phrases, and then we get back a much more full version of that?
Yes. And usually, so first of all, unfortunately, we still have to do all of our work, right? We can't offload it. I agree. But yeah, it's not smart. And so it really doesn't know what you're looking for. But then once you tell it, give this feedback. And depending on the prompt, and the prompt, the term I'm using the prompt is the input that you're giving it, you can describe how you want the feedback to look, how you want it formatted. And so you could ask it to explain what went wrong as well as that it was wrong, saving you a lot of time in that sense. So the student gets more useful feedback and you aren't spending that much extra time crafting it. You just would do a proofread of it when it comes out and make sure that it was telling you the right thing.
So it's a minor time saver.
It depends on a minor time saver multiplied by however many students you have. So it adds up. Yeah, it really
especially
does.
Especially at the midterms, end of terms, when honestly grades are due in a few days and I've got, 45 essays to grade.
Exactly.
Those kind of scenarios.
Yeah, it really can add up. I'm going to be this year, I'm going to be calculating the amount of time that I spent on grading certain things that I've done in the past. And I'm going to use GPT and I'm going to see after all is said and done, how much did I save?
Oh,
was this
great.
Worth it? So we'll
please
see.
Please share that info with me. I'm just really curious to know, right? Because you are really doing the work. You're just not maybe taking the time to write out the feedback, but you've done all the thought work.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
How about research support? Can it save us in any areas there or be helpful?
So it can be helpful and harmful at the same time. So there are plugins and there are a lot of AI tools, and you're starting to see them. Google now has one. Bing is partnered with ChatGPT that if you search, it's going to give you a comprehensive response, not just links. And so if you search one of the larger search engines, you might be able to get information that you weren't necessarily going to get otherwise, or you might see links or places that you might not get otherwise. The downside is they're still for-profit industries. And so a lot of what you're going to see first is whoever paid them to show them first. So you have to dig no matter what, but you can use generative AI to help you get a detailed answer and maybe to find things that you didn't think about. Like when it responds, it might respond with some information and thought, hey, that's new. I didn't know about that. And then you can start, pursuing something else. The downside is, specifically something like GPT, they do know patterns. I actually had a student do this as a joke. I told him sarcastically that he needed to write a 50-page thesis on something because he was telling me that he wasn't gonna be able to make class. And I was saying, that's fine. You just need to write this. And so he did with GPT, and it was 50 pages. It was about the topic. It had citations and everything, and it was all made up.
Isn't that crazy though, right? It's just words.
It is. And the patterns looked right. And if you didn't know what he was writing, there was probably about 8 paragraphs that actually were correct. And then there was lots of stuff that were words. And then there were very good citations with real people, real websites that weren't real, that if you clicked on it, they didn't go there. But that's a problem. There was a lawyer that tried to use GPT, this was last year, and it wasn't real and it got caught. And I don't know if they got disbarred, but it was, it was bad. And that's the problem with generative AI in overall is that it doesn't know. It knows patterns. And everything we do when we communicate are in patterns, like phrases, when we say things. And to the point where if I start talking and stop, you generally have a sense of where I was going to go with that. You would know what the end of my sentence was going to be. That's what it does. But it doesn't know the why. It only has that one piece of information. Our brains have a lot more information that goes into the things that we're saying and thinking about. So research is still a challenge. It can be useful to aggregate information, to summarize information, to write papers if you hate writing. One of my least favorite things to do is write an academic research paper, and it's good at it. And so if you can give it information, it'll format it. And so things like patterns and formats and generating ideas, it's very good at that.
So imagine a university is kind of lagging behind. They don't really have any specific policies related to AI. They don't really use the tools that they could be. They kind of look at AI as like, I don't know, do we even need to worry about it? Or maybe this is just a fast fad. This too shall pass sort of mentality, just sort of like innocently allowing it to happen around them, right? Like, oh, we have more pressing issues maybe, or we'll figure it out later. Maybe that's kind of the mindset too. What do you think the consequences will be for that kind of a university that's just not quite up to speed on this stuff?
So the short answer is it's probably going to be less competitive. Imagine today using overhead projectors and mimeographs, right? 20 years ago, we all did, and that's what it was. It's not, right? That's not something that we would see. We would look at that and say, I don't want to go there, right? And I think that's really probably the biggest concern is that the perception of, yeah, we don't do AI here isn't going to play very well, you know? Also, they're going to lag behind. I mean, there is proven value in what AI is able to do, right? And you don't want to just ignore something that is actually designed to work better for you and to help you. And another thing, and this is going circling way back to things that are changing. So these large language models I just described, you need a supercomputer to run them. You can take a trained model, put it on your laptop, and it'll run, but it'll be so slow that it might give you an answer in a minute and a half instead of immediate. They are working on, and this is an active development, working on what we call small language models, which are doing what the big language models can do, but with a fraction of the size and overhead. So that's probably where things are going. So if you wanted to ask me in 5 years, I don't think that's going to be quite right. But in 10 years, we're going to have the power of GPT on a regular computer, which means everyone is going to be using it because it makes things more efficient. And so you're going to have to at least be aware of it and be ready for it when it comes, as opposed to, I'm not going to use a cell phone because I don't need one, right? And that's, I still know people that do not have cell phones.
I do too. They're in higher ed. Oh. like how fitting is that?
That's perfect.
There was an article in the Inside Higher Ed that stated, AI is emerging as one of the most powerful agents of change in higher education. Sean, tell us your predictions for how GPT will affect us in the next couple of years. How is it going to transform our industry?
So yeah, that's actually an interesting quote, because it's really not just academia, it's the world. Like, AI is the next big thing. It has been for a long time. It's just most people haven't seen it coming. So if you think about your phone, think about all the things that AI has to do with your phone, and just a thumbnail sketch, if you are using maps in any way, everything about it, how to get there, how it reroutes, how it tells you how long you have to go, all of that's AI powered. Autocorrect and autocomplete when you're using it, that's all AI powered. Text to speech or speech to text. All of that's AI. Matter of fact, that is the stuff that when I was saying that no one knew who I was. Yeah, we've been working on this stuff for years and no one thought about it.
Thank you for working on it. It does actually, it's very wonderful.
Right, but that's just your phone, right? Businesses are already using it and have been for a while. Most of the time, if you're trying to chat with someone, you're not chatting with a person until they can't understand what you want, and then they move it over to person. It's an AI chatbot that you're talking to. Your car, they estimated between 1 and 200 computers are in every modern car. And things like fuel efficiency, braking, all of the things that help the car run, AI is using that. It's using AI to make decisions and determinations and for safety. Milwaukee Tool, almost all of the tools, all the high-end tools, that's the word. All of the high-end tools that they make have been designed by AI and have an AI chip in them. So for example, if you have a drill, if you are trying to screw something in, you can feel the torque, right? And so when the torque gets to a certain level, it knows to back off on the power so you're not stripping the screw. Simple things like that. So it's everywhere. And it's going to be everywhere. So really, it's changing what we're doing now with the generative AI and GPT is we're changing the way that we're interacting with computers. We're changing the way that we're interacting with the internet. And so in a few years, it's going to be normal to no longer have to figure out keywords to search in Google to find something. You're just going to be able to, and people are doing this already, you're just going to be able to ask your phone, tell me something about this. It's going to go do the search and it's going to tell you about that. And that's not that far off because that's not much more than what we're doing already. And so because we're going to make it more natural, we're going to make everything easier, the barrier of entry to do a lot of these things is going to be lower. And so more people are going to be able to actually leverage and use all the things that we have. And I think that's probably the biggest short-term benefit that we're going to see.
So I just want to go back and highlight what you said about what will happen to universities that are sort of allowing AI to swirl around them without being proactive, is that they're going to be less competitive. And that's that lack of adapting to where we are now as a society and what students are going to need to be prepared for in the workforce too. They're going to want to know how to use AI tools appropriately, how it could apply, how to assist them in their own jobs. All right, Sean, as we wrap up, what's your best advice for colleges to operate a viable institution? It could be related to AI, but it could be related to other trends as well.
So you kind of said it just now, is that they need to be able to adapt, right? Any good institution is going to change as the demands in the time changes. And so right now it's AI, it's going to be something else in the future. And also, like you said, students are going to need to know this. Students are probably going to be expected to do this or use it in some capacity in jobs that they get to. And so they're really going to need to at least understand it. Whether or not they leverage it, whether or not they teach it, at least having an understanding of what it is, accepting that it's there, and probably having some policies in place to help guide students into how to use it. At a bare minimum, I think that's probably important. We don't need to like jump in feet first like we did at MSOE. We did because we had the research and we were already working on it. But you don't necessarily need AI to function as an institution right now. But you need to know what it can do so that when you come to a problem where you can use it, you're ready to use it. So yeah, mostly just keeping current. And if you don't have somebody in-house that is actually up on that, that's interested in that, that's a challenge. Someone is going to need to take ownership of that and at least follow trends and follow what's happening to keep people informed.
Sean, thank you so much for being here today. I know we're going to have listeners who want to reach out to you and learn more about your work that is now a hot commodity, previously completely unknown. I will make sure to include your biography page on the MSOE website in our show notes. Thank you again.
Thank you, Randy.
To support the cause of the affordable college experience, visit us at highlevelleadership.com. Read our blog and join our email list to get connected. Follow us and leave a positive review on your favorite podcast app. Let's get down to college business.